My name is Judith Kolakoff, and I'm a member of Jewish Voices Against the Occupation, and it is my very great pleasure and privilege to welcome you here tonight for what I know will be an exciting presentation and a marvelous experience, learning experience for us. I speak and welcome you on behalf of not just Jewish Voices Against the Occupation, but by all of the sponsors of the event, and they include Congregation Etzor, Social Action Committee, Pursue the Peace, Palestine Concerns Group of St. Mark's Cathedral, Kadima, and the American Friends Service Committee. I don't know how many of you heard Steve Scherer's program this morning on KUOW, but our speakers were interviewed for an hour, and it was really a very powerful and well-done broadcast. And I guess I would urge you, because we've had some difficulty in the past getting speakers on this issue onto that show, to really write your thanks and support to Steve Scherer for having aired this, and tell him this is what we want more of. Okay? Thank you. All right. Tonight, as I said, it is my real privilege and pleasure to introduce our speakers from Taiyush. Said it right? Mm-hmm. Said it right. Taiyush is the Arabic word not for coexistence, as it mistakenly said on these flyers, but for living together. And that is indeed a significant difference. If you think in terms of the meaning of coexistence, which means you live side by side and kind of tolerate each other without war and struggle, or if you think about truly, truly living together, which is what Taiyush is all about, which is what it tries to model through its own activities and through its own experience of learning to live together as Israeli Palestinians and Israeli Jews. Taiyush is an Israeli organization, and it is a group of Israeli Arabs and Jews who work together to prove by example and by project that both peoples can live together as equals in two countries, Israel and Palestine. Our speakers tonight are Taiyush activists from the Jerusalem, and I don't know if you call it chapter or not, but whatever, it's the Jerusalem group, right? Okay. The interesting thing was that when we were ready to prepare these events and to schedule them, we got a picture of our two speakers. We knew one was an Israeli-Palestinian, and we knew one was an Israeli-Jew. And what we couldn't figure out by just looking at the picture was who was which, which makes a statement, I think, about who we are as Jews and Arabs and the common roots from which we come, and really the closeness of who we are as people. So that was a rather interesting and significant exercise. Lina Daleshe is, in fact, the Palestinian, the Israeli Palestinian. And Noah Nativ is the Israeli Jew. And I'm not going to say too much about them. I'm going to let them tell you their own stories because they do it far more better than anything I could say. What I will tell you is that you are in for a real treat because they are powerful, exciting, impassioned, and principled people to listen to. So I give them to you, and I will vacate the stage.
Hi. First, we both would like to thank our hosts for having us here and you for coming and hearing us. So, I'm Noah Nativ. I'm 26 years old. I live in Jerusalem. I'm doing my master's degree right now in computational linguistics. If you haven't heard ever about the field, it's okay. Me and five other people, apparently. And I come from a very apolitical home. nobody around me has ever been active in anything social or political before. I never was either. I was born into the occupation, actually. You know, this is the situation which I grew up into as normal. Anyway, I never did anything social or political before. It was something that other people do. It was something even, you know, political activity was even considered something dirty that normal people don't do. And what changed that for me was the events of October 2000. The terrible escalation of violence and the way things were just slipping out of hand, and everybody around me seemed to think that, you know, using violence was the way to solve violence, and I thought that was just solely a screwed up logic. I couldn't understand how that could work. And I couldn't understand how I could sit back and just watch these things happening, watch my country perform crimes of war and not do anything about it. So I shared these feelings with a friend, and he told me about a group that he and a few other people were just establishing, a group of Ta'ayush. That was actually the second group of Ta'ayush that was made up. The first group was set up several months before that, 1 month after the Intifada began in November 2000. So I joined the new group, and I thought about integrating, you know, just a bit of activism into my life, and I found that it completely doesn't work that way. That once you take down the walls of detachment and the difference between yourself and the world around you, you can't keep to yourself. There are so many things that just call out for action and just draw you more and more into it. But actually, the new load of activities wasn't the hardest thing about becoming an activist. The hardest part was being exposed to all the new information that I suddenly was surrounded by. It was allowing myself to feel, finally, after all those years of not even acknowledging all the exposed nerves around me, finally allowing myself to feel rage, to feel pain, to feel anger, to feel empathy. And it was really quite a shocking experience, finding out all the information that I had never been aware of before. You know, the Israeli society is really segregated. There's the Palestinian society, and there's the Jewish society within Israel. And they just don't come into contact. We go to different schools, we hang around in different groups, usually we also live in different cities. Even in the university where we both go together, we just remain apart. So I never had any Palestinian friend before who could tell me about those things. And many of the things that I found out were simply non-issues in the wider Israeli society. I found out, you know, suddenly about what Israel had been doing in the occupied territories for 35 years. I found about all the injustice and all the discrimination that had and still is going on within Israel. I found out about so many things that I just simply didn't know before. I can tell you about the first time, I think, that I understood what it means to be in Palestinian in the occupied territories these days. It was one day when we were preparing a convoy, you know, those convoys that you saw in the video, they take a whole lot of preparation in advance. You have to meet several people several times in advance. You have to go to the destination of our convoy several times to meet with the people and to see how the activity is going to go, plan it together, to set up the security measures that have to be taken. So this was on one day when we were going to a village which we considered as a destination for a trip, for a convoy. And we were just leaving the village. And we were several people together in the Jeep, you know, several Jews and Palestinians from within the occupied territories and from within Israel and from the occupied territories. And as we were leaving the village, we passed by a Jewish settlement that's right nearby, and in the middle of the road there was a settler waiting for us with his gun drawn. And I don't know what he wanted. We managed to go around him and not stop. He probably just wanted to interrogate us, but his demeanor told the whole story. You know, as someone that feels he's the lord of the land and feels that he can, you know, just stand in the middle of the road and pull people over with his gun. And a short while later, we were stopped by an army vehicle. And the soldiers wanted to know who we were and why we were together and where we were going. And the whole interaction took place with their guns pointed at us. And, you know, they let us go after a couple of minutes. They really had nothing to hold against us. And it was probably not even an extraordinary situation for them. They were afraid. I can understand their fear. It's not even their fault. It's the whole occupation that put them in this situation. But the feeling of being on the other side of the gun, of having a gun pointed at you as the default form of communication, that was a shocking experience for me. It let me experience the fear and the hostility that every Palestinian feels as the mundane, everyday life under occupation. And, you know, these were my own people on the other side of the gun, but it still was a terrible experience for me. And I think that every Israeli should go through this experience just once, you know, to understand what it means to be on the other side of the story. You know, these experiences really shake you up. You suddenly encounter all sorts of facts that you didn't know. You know, I grew up on Zionism. My family is a good Zionist family, Israeli-Jewish family. And I never had any idea about the implications that Zionism had for the people around me, for Palestinians living just 5 minutes from where I live. Needless to say about the people under occupation, although I don't really consider occupation a form of Zionism. So these encounters, these experiences just had me facing a reality that I had never faced before, and it had me, you know, questioning the very basis of my identity as an Israeli, my identity as a human being, my identity as someone that's living in such a situation and simply can't go on being silent. And to some extent, it really is an identity crisis, you know. And I often feel very alienated from quite a few people around me. I know that many people disagree with me. Many people think that I'm, you know, going against the Jewish cause, the Israeli cause, and I can't but disagree, you know. This is a hard thing to go through, to be against so many people, but I really feel that this knowledge and these experiences have given me such a privilege to be able to deal with the situation, because if you don't know these things, if you don't have the basis of understanding why people are so desperate on the Palestinian side, you just get totally wrapped up in your fear and your anger because of all the suicide attacks on Israel, that you are blinded to the other side of the story, to the complete picture of our reality in which we live. And, you know, I can tell you that, you know, when you don't know these things, you really are afraid, you really are angry in Israel. You know, we both live in Israel, in Jerusalem, which is the city that's probably most affected by terrorism. So we can tell you a bit of what it means to live with this constant fear penetrating every aspect of your life. Not only if you were personally hurt by it, but just this constant awareness that your life is in danger. I can tell you that the streets of Jerusalem are empty right now, that the cafes are deserted and businesses are closing, and people are afraid to be in the city, to walk, to go outside their homes. I know that whenever I simply have to be in the center of town, I try to get there through back alleys. Whenever I have to cross the street, I try to avoid standing near large groups of people, so I stand a couple of feet down from the streetlight. Every time there's a loud noise, I immediately get tense, and every time I hear more than two ambulances in the row, I open up the radio to see if anything's happened. And every time there is a terrorist attack, I immediately call up all my friends and my family, so, you know, to check if they're okay and to let them know that I'm okay, so they won't worry themselves mad. And, you know, this fear, this ongoing presence of this in your life also means a very nasty feeling of expectation every time there's a terrorist attack in Israel for Israel's response in some refugee camp or Palestinian town, and a very nasty feeling of seeing this whole cycle of bloodshed being replayed in front of your eyes again, where, you know, the only variables are the names and the numbers and the places. It's a very nasty feeling to go with, you know, all the time. And if this is all you get exposed to, and most Israeli Jews, this is really all they get exposed to. They don't know about anything else. Then you get totally tied up in your fear and your anger, and you're blinded. You demonize the other. If you can't understand what's leading people to blow themselves up in the middle of the street, and, you know, I totally condemn that. But I understand what made them do that. I understand the situation that they've been put in, the desperation. If you don't know that, you demonize the other side. You say, okay, well, you know, it's their nature to kill them, to kill us. It's their nature to hate us. And it just gives you no tools to deal with the situation, to see any possible solution for the situation. And this is really sad. You know, people have been, when they demonize the other side, when they think that violence is the only thing that can work to solve the situation, then you totally surrender your critical capacities. You just say, you know, well, Sharon has, you know, has the right way to deal with them, just through more violence and through hitting them harder where it hurts. And you're really just being abused by the people who've got an interest to keep you thinking this way, because I don't see any other way in which Sharon's government would have ever been elected in any other circumstances than people totally giving up their critical capacities, totally surrendering their free thought. And knowledge gives you the tools to deal with the situation, gives you the alternative to this violence. Without this, you're captive in the hands of people who have an interest to keep you in this situation. And this is what we try to do in Ta'ish. We try to break down the walls of ignorance and fear. We try to show people the situation for themselves. In those convoys that you saw, we try to take people to the occupied territories to show them what the reality there is, to show the Palestinian people there that there is a willingness on the Israeli side, that there are Israelis that want a different reality, that violence has an alternative. We try to act in non-violent ways to show that there is some hope for a better future. I think I'll let Lina speak now.
My name is Lina Dallashi. I was born in a small village in the Galilee in the north of Israel called Liberi. I finished this year my law degree at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and articling at the lawyer's office in Jerusalem. I want to tell you my point of view as a Palestinian Israeli young woman who lives in Israel, who have grown up and been raised in Israel. I want to tell you about the everyday life, about growing up in Israel and what it meant and how eventually it brought me to Daesh. As I said, I'm Palestinian Israeli. I'm a part of an unrecognized national minority. We are We can vote to the Knesset, to the parliament, and we can have representation, but not as a group. Our group rights are denied, our rights as natives or indigenous are denied. We are not acknowledged as Palestinians, as Palestinian minority of 80% of the Israeli population. 18%.
18.
Or else we wouldn't have been a minority. And after 54 years of Israeli existence, we're still treated as a second-class citizens, as unwanted guests in our own land. The mere definition of Israel as a Jewish state deprives me my existence, my identity, my nationality. And Israel has always tried to deny me my identity, as Palestinian has always tried to deprive me my right of being me. And in the same time, it doesn't give me an alternative. I know I would never have the sense of belonging to Israel. And what I want is being Palestinian and being Israeli citizen. And I can get that. The school I go to doesn't teach me my history. I've learned about Jewish history and about Zionism, but I've never learned my history, my personal history, my national history. The war of 1948, I've never learned about it as from the Palestinian perspective. The word Nakba was never heard at my school. The Palestinian catastrophe, my catastrophe, has never been told. And living through that, if you're not raised in enough politically aware house, you could just lose your identity, you could forget you're Palestinian. And many people I know just could miss that point. And in the same time, I and any Palestinian Israel would never have the sense of belonging. And I want to tell you about a story, an everyday story, that actually gave me the strongest feeling of strangeness I've ever had to go through. It was when I went through the so-called security check. And I've heard about it a lot from friends, of being stopped in the streets, or in the mall, or everywhere. And interrogated and humiliated. And I've almost never had it because I don't have the look. I don't fit into the stigma of how does a Palestinian look or how does a Palestinian talk, and I don't have an accent when I speak. And I've almost never had it. And last year, at this beautiful Jerusalem summer day, I went shopping with a friend, and she's Muslim, and she covers her hair. And while we were walking in the street in the city center, we were stopped by two policemen and asked to give our IDs and for us to stand 45 minutes in this midday hot sun of Jerusalem, while passerbys just looking at us, this humiliating looks. And we were asked all these unnecessary questions like, where are you going and where are you coming from and what are you doing and why are you here? And we were shouted at and we were threatened to be taken into custody only because we asked to be released or at least let's stand in the shadow. As a law student, I know that he couldn't take us into custody. As Arab, I knew the law wasn't always applied as it is. And after 45 minutes, we were released. We were let go, Because they had nothing to check. We were both law-obeying citizens of Israel. We were both students in the Hebrew University. And we showed identifications to prove it. And we were just walking down the street. And we were stopped only because we're Arabs. You're an Arab in this state, so you're just a suspect. And if you hadn't gone through this experience of degradation, if you haven't gone through this humiliation, you couldn't understand the rage a person could feel, the pain, the humiliation of being stopped in your own streets, in your own city, only because you are Palestinian, of being treated as a suspect only because you are who you are. And can you imagine being stopped just walking down the streets of Seattle and interrogated and humiliated and asked to identify only because you are who you are? And I hope no one ever goes through that experience, because it's really painful and it really gets to you. And it's not the only thing I suffer from, we Palestinians suffer from in Israel. Israel has limited our political rights to a great extent, to the extent that we approve and acknowledge the Jewish majority rule, to the extent that we are willing to give up our identity. And many Palestinians who have tried to struggle against it, many Palestinian Israelis that have tried to fight for their full rights acknowledgement have been forced to pay a huge personal price. My parents are an example for that. My parents were both activists when they were in the university and afterwards while they were teachers. And my mom was inspired 3 years after she began to teach, and my father had to lead this long legal struggle to prevent his firing. And for them, it's very hard to accept my activity. It's very hard because they're afraid I'm going to have to pay the price that they have paid, and they don't want their daughter to go through what they went through. And growing up into that, I understood that this attitude of Israel towards me is because of my identity, because of my belonging to Palestinian nation. And I understood that all of this has come of the same place, the occupation and the discrimination come from my being Palestinian. And I tried to fight against it. I was activist during the years, but then comes October 2000 and I stopped fighting. The Palestinian Israelis go into demonstrations against the discrimination and against occupation, and as identification with the Palestinians in the occupied territories, and the Israeli police responds with fierce violence. And 13 citizens killed by Israeli police. 13 Palestinian young citizens were killed by the police. And the Israeli left was not there. The Israeli left abandoned us. They sat aside and watched crimes being made in their names. They sat aside and they let the government treat us with this violence. And treating Palestinians within Israel and in occupied territories with this violence. And they were disappointed of the Palestinian side, and that's why they allowed crimes to be committed. And a lot of lives were lost, and I was desperate. And I was disappointed, and I couldn't go on. I just lose my trust in people. I lose my trust in Jewish people. I lose my trust in peace. I blame myself for being naive and believing all these years on our chances to live together, on our chances to have peace in the area. And I went around with this feeling for a long time, until I met a friend last year, the end of October, and he just said, "Lena, I've got the thing that is just for you." And I said, "There's nothing for me. I stopped believing. I don't want to be active. I don't believe in Jewish people, and I don't believe in these struggles." And he said, "Please come and listen. One meeting is what I'm asking you, and afterwards you can do whatever you want." And I came to the meeting, and I was so pleasantly surprised. I couldn't believe something like that exists. I actually ended up asking him, "How comes I and many like me haven't heard about the group long time ago?" And for me, the Irish gave me back my hope. Gave me back my hope of our chances in living together, of the possibility of that happening, of having it as a part of our life. And the Irish is a group of really good people working together, Palestinians and Jews, side by side, to end the occupation, to end the discrimination, and to prove by living it, by simply living it, that we can live together. And I sound so good, and it sounds like everything is perfect, but it's not. Sometimes I just stop and get tired and desperate, and I have self-doubts, and I wonder if what we're doing worth anything. If we're doing anything for real, if we've got a chance, if we're actually changing anything. And I think maybe we're just a part of this system that is causing all this injustice. And maybe we're just this beautiful cover of that ugliness. And it's hard, and it's one of the hardest feelings one could go with. When you doubt yourself, and what do? But I stop and I think about it rationally, and I speak to friends, and I see what we do, and I see that we are doing something, that we are bringing this little hope to people, that maybe we are lighting this little light in this darkness that have took over our area for the last year and a half. And I see that maybe we're not preventing the evil from happening, but we're helping ease the pain a bit for these people who are suffering. We're helping bring a bit of hope to people. We're helping showing people what's actually happening in the occupied territories and within Israel. We're helping people see the truth for themselves and not as the Israeli government tries to show it. If we are actually maintaining our hope of peace. And I come to here in hard days. I left Jerusalem a few days after two very hard suicide bombings. 26 Israeli citizens have been killed in the streets of Jerusalem. And for me as a Palestinian, the experience is much harder. The fear is doubled. I'm afraid of exploding and being killed by explosion in a bus. And I'm afraid of being lynched by a right-wing mob. And at these like these, you just could easily lose the hope and just take off and just get to the farthest place you can and just start leaving. But still, being in Paris, being in this group, working together, gives me the hope that we can live together, the hope that us peace lovers will actually overcome eventually.
Well, now that we've given you our personal angles on the situation and how we go into that, maybe we'll tell you a bit about what we do. Because Ta'ayushi is a group of action. Well, we've got all sorts of activities that we carry out together in working towards our goals. One which you've seen in that video that we showed you is convoys that we organize, mass convoys to the occupied territories, hoping to bring people together, hoping to bring a bit of help, humanitarian aid, and help, the real substantial help that we think is really the long-term help, changing opinions, both for people there and for people within Israel.
Another type of our actions is demonstration. We don't like this type of action very much because we believe working costs much more. But sometimes we are forced to do it. Sometimes we have no other alternative, so we go and we demonstrate at checkpoints, in the streets of Israeli cities, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and we protest the occupation. We protest the injustice that is inferred for because of this occupation, and we demand a better future for us all.
For instance, I think demonstration that we had just several weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, was inside Israel, in front of Gtziot detention camp. This is the place where detainees are taken by the thousands after each invasion Israel has into the occupied territories. They're taken there without any proper recognition, without any trial, actually. They're not being tried for anything. They're not getting any legal representation. They're being held there in really subhuman conditions, totally isolated from the world around them. So we came there several weeks ago, several hundred people, stood on a hill right above the detention camp. We sent in packets with newspapers so they'd have some information about what's going on in the outside world. Cigarettes, packets, some clothes that would help them with bare necessities. We came with loudspeakers and sounded music to encourage them a bit. We called out stuff to them. And we freed balloons with peace written on them so they'd be able to see from where they are.
Another type of activity is actually one time when Israeli army was reoccupying the refugee camps and when suicide bombers were exploding in Israeli streets, we decided to go and donate blood. At that time, we knew that the refugee camp hospitals were in a great short for blood. So we went, 150 Palestinian Jews, to Makassid Hospital in East Jerusalem and donated blood in favor of these refugee camps. We went there to say in our own blood that we can live together. And just a few weeks ago, I found out that solidarity works both ways. When a Jewish friend of ours, an activist in Daesh, was hospitalized, and a few days afterwards, her spouse got a phone call from a friend from Ramallah, a friend that they've met in one of our activities. And the friend in Ramallah offered to donate blood in favor of the wife. And he knew that getting out from Ramallah to Jerusalem would just be getting through hell and back of checkpoints, of humiliation, of degradation, of even the chance of being taken into custody. And eventually the blood wasn't needed, but I believe that was it needed, he would have come.
Just a couple of months back, we also went, when there was danger that Israel would again, the Israeli government would again invade the Gaza Strip. We went there with a big group to the checkpoint in the entrance to the Gaza Strip. We took an empty bus with us and suggested that the soldiers return with us. Unfortunately, they didn't come, but we got the message through, I think.
One other type of actions that we have is voluntarily work camps. In these, we go masses, hundreds of people, to unrecognized Palestinian villages within Israel. These are villages that have existed before 48, but the Israeli government does not acknowledge their existence, and thus they get no services, no infrastructure, no water, no electricity, no roads, no health services, no schooling, nothing of the state. And we go there, masses, we work together, we pave roads, we plant trees, we set playgrounds for kids in the village, and we come to say together that we protest this, that to show people what is actually happening, to say that these villages need to be acknowledged and to get services like every other place in Israel. And at these work camps, we get to meet together, to work together, and actually even have some fun together, being families together, sitting together, eating together, just being for a weekend together and getting to know that it is possible, and showing that it is possible to live together.
Another thing we had several months back is another case of active resistance, which is kind of what we try to do. Was in Isawiya, which is a village, a Palestinian village, that's about 2 minutes from where I spend most of my time in the Hebrew University. It's right adjacent to the Hebrew University. It's within the municipal borders of Jerusalem. And one day, several months back, the police simply decided to put a road barricade, a dirt barricade, at the entrance of the village for no reason whatsoever. They wouldn't explain why they did that. Probably just for sheer harassment. So we decided together with the people of the village to take apart the dirt barricade together. And that's what we actually tried to do. We arrived there again, hundreds, and some of the people took apart the dirt barricade while other people were standing in front of them in lines, linked arms, trying to stop the police, which didn't like what we were doing, from stopping us. And we didn't manage to get it to get the dirt barricade down. We got it down about three quarters of the way, but the police used extreme force against us. Some of our people were actually hospitalized during that activity. Others were arrested, and afterwards the police put up the whole barricade again. But we went there afterwards to the police station where our people were being held, those that got arrested, with the people from the village. We all went there together. And I don't know, it was very touching to be on the same side of the story, you know, not on two different sides. And I think our solidarity, we've been in constant contact with them ever since. We've had several activities in Isawiya. And these things are important, these long-term contacts.
Which brings us to one of our longest and probably most important project of the, especially for the Daesh group in Jerusalem, in which we both belong. This is the project of South Hebron. It's a project that we we'd like to share it with a bit more details with you, because we believe that it's a project that you could adapt and help us with and be involved with. So I'm just going to give you a historical briefing, and Noah will tell you a bit more about our activities. We're speaking about people who are in the danger of expulsion. It's people who have been living in these lands in South Hebron for generations, and they've been maintaining this unique lifestyle of living in caves and tents and making their livings from agriculture and maintaining livestock. And it's really weak population of people that actually all that they have is these lands, this agriculture, and this livestock. And that's all what they've got. And through the years, they've lost a great deal of their land. In 1948, they've lost a lot of land when they became under Jordanian rule, and part of their land stayed under Israeli rule. And in 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and announced a great deal of their lands as a closed military zone, denying them from that land. So these people are actually living in, their life space was actually so limited when Israel began in the 1980s to build settlements. And few settlements have been built on the lands of these people in that area ever since, with the intention of annexing this land. This land is just by the ceasefire border of 67, and Israel intends to annex this area and have a territorial contiguation from Beersheba in the north, in the south of Israel, to the Jewish settlement in Hebron. And in May 1999, the Barak government, along with the settlers' leaders, have committed the first organized expulsion. 750 people were expelled from their lands in the pretense of invading state land, a land that they've been in before the state was established, but still they've invaded state land. And these people have turned to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ordered them back until further discussion. And despite the Supreme Court's order, these people have been constantly harassed by Israeli army and by settlers. Their houses have been demolished, their water wells, the only resource of water that they have been demolished, their agriculture was destroyed, their livestock was killed, and their many limitations were put in their ability to move in their lands. And we believe that the different governments have been taking these actions for the same underlying motivation, to annex this land without the Palestinian citizens in it. And it's not a fiction, it's not something that we just believe. It's the Israeli government have stated in the Camp David talks that they want to annex this area, and many governmental people have actually said it, unofficially, but have said it, that they want this land free of the Palestinian citizens of it.
Now, maybe I'll tell you several words about the implications of these expulsions. The idea of transfer, of that's the way expulsion has been dubbed in the Israeli discourse, has started out somewhere at the extreme right of the Israeli society, and very slowly but consistently filtered into the center of the Israeli discourse. Although, of course, expulsion is something that is completely unacceptable and by any international or moral norms. In other places, it's called ethnical cleansing. But somehow in Israeli society, it's like this fantasy, you know, that the other people would somehow disappear and that would solve all the problems. So it's gained more and more popularity, and we're afraid that right now this is a test case where if these expulsions really do take place, this paves the road to much wider cases of expulsion, both inside Israel and in the occupied territories. So the implications of what happens in the case of South Hebron are much wider than the case itself. The case of this specific case has been in court debate, as Leon told you, since 1999. Ever since, there have been several cases of expulsion. The fact that the Supreme Court ordered that it won't happen doesn't prevent it from happening. The army just keeps on doing it, defying the verdict, the Supreme Court's decision to not have them evicted until further discussion is and you know this question is brought to a final decision. Ta'ayush has joined the struggle of these people about a year ago. We've organized a convoy to the area after about 2 months after another expulsion took place, and the people came back again after another Supreme Court decision. We organized the convoy. We got there, you know, several hundred people. It was all went very well until 2 days later, after our convoy, when they were again expelled from their area. So Ta'ayush activists got there as soon as possible, and we actually stayed the night with these people outside until the court ordered yet another order not to expel them the following day. And actually Ta'ayush activists managed to prevent another case of expulsion the following morning when the army again arrived and demanded that they leave the place immediately. So we managed to prevent that from happening. We won't let that happen. And, the court ordered that they remain where they are, the Palestinian inhabitants of the area. Ever since, throughout the year, we've held several convoys to the area. One time we went there to help them harvest their olives, because they can't get to their olive trees. The nearby settlement won't let them pass by to their olive trees because they say it's a security threat for the settlers. So we got there and we managed to have them. Actually, we didn't manage to get to the area itself because the military declared the area a closed military zone. But we reached kind of a very absurd status quo. You know, we won't be able, the left activists won't be able to get to the area, but on the other hand, as long as we remained, you know, outside and wouldn't move until they actually managed to harvest their olives, the settlers won't be able to harass them. So that's the way it sometimes goes. Another time we got there to bring them blankets because they're not allowed to build any permanent buildings until the Supreme Court reaches its verdict. So they're exposed to the very harsh South Hebron winter and winds. So we got them blankets. Another time we harvested wheat together. We have constant visits to the area. We're in constant phone contact. Actually, I'd like to show you something that I got at one of the visits that we had to the area, just a small visit of several, you know, 25 people. One of the girls over there gave me this. This is something that she herself made. It has an Israeli flag on one side and the Palestinian flag on the other side. And she said, you know, just hang it on your mirror in your car whenever you're in the occupied territories, have this side. Whenever you're in Israel, put it this way. But actually, I never put it on because I don't think that my car would survive, like, for 5 minutes with this thing on. But it's very I think it says something about the way people, we, you know, people react to what we do, people react to our activities, and there's no cynicism involved when we do that, you know, when there's no cynicism involved on their side either. It touched me, I don't know. We've been in constant contact with these people, and we're really afraid now of what will happen. The court is supposed to reach its decision within the next month or so, and we're afraid that it will reach a decision that these people must go. And if this happens, we intend to actively resist that. We intend to be there with them, and we'd like to help you to get your help on that too. I mean, we don't expect you to reach there physically yourselves, obviously, but we think that it's a political decision. It's not a matter of whether they're sitting on state lands or not. It's a matter of whether expulsion, whether transfer will be allowed, will be legitimized or not. And political, as far as political decisions go, the United States has an incredible amount of influence on what goes on in Israel. I speak with people and they say, you know, how can you agree to these things happening? And they say, well, you know, if the states can have, you know, do what it does in Afghanistan, why can't we do what we do here? So there's an amazing amount of you know, people look up to the states, people feel that if these things are legitimized internationally, then they can get these things done. So we'd like to help, get your help in preventing that. We'd like to help, get your help in creating, I don't know, pressure groups inside the states, writing letters to the Ministry of Defense, Israel's Ministry of Defense, writing letters to consulates or to embassies. Do what you can to influence, because you have a lot of power, you have a lot of force. Maybe you're not aware of that, but you really do. We need your help here. These people need your help.
And to sum up, I'm asking you to see the whole picture in the area. I'm asking you to see what is happening in our cursed or blessed land. I'm asking you to see the pain that is suffered there, to see the injustice that is inferred because of the occupation. I'm asking you to interfere in our name, on our behalf, Israelis and Palestinians, and on behalf of our common humanity. I'm asking you to demand that your government and your people work with us to end this madness. I'm asking you to help us end the occupation, to help us get to peace, and to help us have a chance to prosper. Thank you.